Welcome and welcome back to the Radio Thrift Shop with DJ Frederick. Broadcasting on WSCS 90.9 FM in New London, online at classicalwscs.org, on the Global Voice, and Pinecone Radio. On the Radio Thrift Shop, I spin a variety of 33s, 45s, 78s, cassette tapes, 8-tracks, reel-to-reels, and even a few CDs from the past 100 years of recorded sound. A little bit later in the hour, we're going to hear a documentary on the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting, brought to you by Mark Durenberger. But before that, we're going to get things cooking with the incredible Tabla Band in a Gotta Da Vida. We'll be right back. very cool set of tunes here on the Radio Thrift Shop. That was Robert Drasnan with Chant of the Moon. Before that, Emil Richards, The Blues for Harry. Cicero with a cover of the Beatles' Come Together, and we started that set off with the incredible tabla band, Inagata De Vida. Before we get into the Pavlik Museum of Broadcasting documentary, let's hear a band from Portland, Maine, with a 7-inch 45 that they released back in early 1970s. Another Beatles cover. This is a band called Catfish with Dear Prudence.
Won't you come out to play? Dear Prudence, greet the brand new day. Hey. Dear Prudence,
Our December 2014 offering is a bit of time travel. We're going to visit the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting and walk through some of the hundreds of exhibits with curator Steve Raymer. A number of you were part of the Pavick experience during our 2013 DX convention, but if you're like me, you can always use and hear another look. We are in a very special place. We're standing next to Steve Raymer, who is the director of the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting.
Thank you, Mark, and it's an honor to be here today, and hopefully we can give you something that is worthwhile. We've got a variety of collections here at the Pavick. We've got Joe Pavick's original collection of old radios from the 20s, and we've got another collection that was put together of radios built in the Twin Cities. But one of our most significant collections was put together by Bing Crosby's audio engineer. His name was Jack Mullen, and it documents the history of recorded sound. It starts with an Edison tinfoil machine. And by the way, if you come here to visit, you can put your hands on this machine and touch it and feel it, really get a sense of how it works. This is the first device capable of recording and playing back the human voice, and it was done on a sheet of tinfoil that was wrapped around a drum in the middle of the device.
This drum looks like it's about, 4 inches in diameter, made out of brass?
Mm-hmm. There's two diaphragms, one on either side of it with the needles attached. You shout into one side, and that diaphragm causes the needle to vibrate. It leaves the footprint of the sound in the tinfoil so that it can be played back.
And then you turn a crank.
Yeah, there's no electric motor on this one. This is 1877. So the playback speed was determined by how fast or how slow you cranked it and what sounded right to you.
And what kind of quality would you expect from this?
Terrible. Yeah. It was terrible, and we actually found some of this old tinfoil and tried to get the thing to work, and the tinfoil would rip and tear, and it's a miracle that he got anything out of this at all. In order to solve those problems, he went to a more permanent media, wax cylinders. Now he could record on one machine and play it back on another.
It's a wooden box, about 14 by 12 by maybe 10. And at the top, there's a disc that presumably goes around.
A cylinder.
Okay. And underneath, there's a cone. It looks like it. Is that the loudspeaker?
Mm-hmm.
Not where the sound comes out?
Mm-hmm.
It's like a big funnel.
And it's you can see how it's based on the original tinfoil machine. There's a cylinder of wax that spins at 160 RPM.
Well, that's what? Five times as fast as the LP record?
Yes. You can get 4 minutes out of one of these cylinders. The earlier ones were 2 minutes. This one's four.
So this is what, spring-powered?
Yeah.
There's a crank on here. That's just for winding up the spring.
Correct.
Okay.
And then it has a flyball governor, so it's like a clockwork motor.
So what are we going to hear here?
I'm going to drop the stylus and diaphragm down on the record, on the cylinder, and, well, let's see if we recognize this tune. The important thing is, though, that Edison initially had to make these one at a time. If you wanted 50 copies of a song, he had to sing it 50 times. By the time he had a system figured out to cast the records, where the record would actually shrink inside the mold, Berliner and Johnson had come up with the flat disc. And they took over the industry because they could just stamp them out.
And so the flat discs were not individually cut. They were
mass produced, and that was the key to their success. And Edison was out of the phonograph business by 1929. Here's a Victor machine, and this is going to be quite a bit louder.
Now we're looking at a 78 RPM?
Yes.
Did 78 become the speed at the very beginning of all of this?
There were a variety of speeds, but this is the one that gave them a nice amount of time, about 3.5 minutes, on a disc, and that sounded good.
10-inch disc. So 78 RPM became the so-called calculated speed to give you 3 to 3.5 minutes on a 10-inch disc.
Correct.
I see. Okay.
Correct. And Edison, he actually ran at 80 RPM.
Why?
Victor patented virtually every step of every process that they did. They had some early legal battles with some of their former employees, and they learned their lesson, and including the materials that they were made of and the speed that they operated at. So when Edison finally succumbed and went over to the flat disc, he couldn't use their speed, he couldn't use their materials.
So he recorded at 80 RPM, and if you had a standard phonograph in your home and played his back, they would have sounded a little slower.
Well, and then the problem was you couldn't play his back on a standard phonograph because his records were vertical cut, deeper and shallower cut, whereas the Victor's were lateral cut, side to side. So here's a Victor machine, and again, this is a... The reproducer bounces back and forth, or the needle bounces back and forth.
Well, now this time I'm looking into a horn that's about 2 feet in diameter, 3 feet deep, and it's coupled. What's that material? Sintered bronze or something, do you think? But it's all acoustically coupled down to a diaphragm that's going to be tickled by the stylus. Am I right?
Yeah, and how big is that diaphragm?
Oh, 2 inches.
2 inches?
Yeah.
So this 2-inch diaphragm moves, what, a 16th of an inch, a 32nd of an inch back and forth.
Depending on the sound that's vibrating the needle.
And it's amazing how much audio you get from that little diaphragm.
Oh, it's getting up to speed. I would note that you had no way of adjusting the volume. This was a direct acoustical thing. I know you're going to show me one in a minute where they were able to do that, but...
And that's where the old term, put a sock in it, comes from. Because you could ball up a pair of socks and throw it inside the horn, and that would quiet it down.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
The recording process at the time was a mirror image of what we just heard. There was, you talked and sang into a horn.
If you had a soft disc on here, a soft plastic disc, Mark and I could shout into this horn, and that diaphragm on the reproducer would vibrate enough to etch the footprint of our sound, of our voices, into that disc.
It had a real inherent drawback in that the low frequencies didn't get through that system, correct?
And it really wasn't until 1925 that they figured this out.
Now Steve is opening a huge piece of furniture.
And once again, this is something that when you come here, you can put your hands on it, you can feel this thing work, you can envision how this record changer operates. This is the first record changer for the home market. This is a playback system that Victor and Bell Labs co-designed. They spent many years working on it, lots of money. And by the time they brought it out to market, it was completely obsolete.
So what we're looking at is a 78 RPM turntable with the acoustical pickup on it, just like the one we just heard. And this one, I'm assuming, gets coupled into a horn somewhere.
It's a much larger horn, and the diaphragm on the acoustical pickup is no longer a flat sheet of mica. It's a dome of aluminum, and aluminum at the time was a precious metal. And there's ball bearings in the mechanism. And again, it was completely obsolete by the time it was introduced because by 1927, we had vacuum tube amplifiers.
So we were into electrical recording by that time.
Yes. Yeah. And the proper records for this, the orthophonic records, were recorded electrically using a microphone, and then they were equalized to be played back acoustically.
There's a record on the turntable. Remember, folks, we're talking about 78 RPM discs, which are extremely fragile. What are they made out of?
They're made out of slate dust and shellac.
So if I drop one on a hard floor, it would shatter?
They would break,
yeah.
Yeah.
So you wonder what the machine is going to do with it. It's got one disc up in the air.
On a hook, and actually we could have put a dozen discs up there.
All right, see what it does.
Okay.
Now, this one you said has a huge horn on it. May I open this?
Yes. Unfortunately, all you can see is grill cloth.
Okay, but it's big.
Yeah, and we're not able to really... It's somewhere between 8 and 12 feet total length. And, of course, the horn begins at the reproducer. And that acoustic tube counts as the length of the...
So the sound travels through the tube that's holding the needle on the record,
mm-hmm.
and then down through some kind of a chamber somewhere that
yes.
gets bigger and bigger?
And a big chunk of that chamber is cast iron.
Mercy.
They determined that cast iron would not diminish the sound. And then the final opening is a spruce horn. So they have a very, scientifically...
It's quite well-crafted, isn't it? So now, back to your comment about put a sock in it. And that's essentially what we're going to demonstrate here, correct?
Well, first of all, we're going to drop the tone arm on the record. We have an electric motor now. And that's full volume right there.
Now, the doors are open.
Should I turn it down?
It's pretty loud. Yeah, Steve, turn it down.
That's
got quieter. And now the doors are closed. So if I wanted it a little bit louder, just partially open one of the doors. That's such happy music, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit too happy. I'm going to get rid of it.
Mechanically, it took the record off the turntable, these delicate records off the turntable, and shoved it down a slot, took the one that was hanging in the air, and now it's on the machine. My goodness.
So if you recognize this voice.
I don't recognize the voice yet.
You will. Maybe.
Virginia. That's Bing Crosby.
Very good. Now, your listeners didn't have a chance to hear that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know who that is. And again, this is all acoustic. We haven't even begun to get to the electric recordings.
And again, this was completely obsolete by the time it was introduced because we had amplifiers and we had microphones by 1927.
And that led us to the following demonstration.
We do have a demo here that shows the difference between an acoustic recording and an electrical recording. Mullen was able to find both these versions of a recording. He found the electrical recording and the acoustic recording of the same tune. That's the source, sound source that you're going to hear.
What are we going to hear first?
I bet you'll be able to figure it out. This is the acoustic version. And it's better than it should be.
Now we've switched. All right, that was amazing.
This is the lathe that cut the discs for the first talkies.
What's a lathe?
Well, a lathe is a device that turns at a precise speed, and there's a cutting head that moves across the record at a predetermined rate.
So that threaded screw goes around at X RPM. And that drives a mechanism that slowly moves the cutting needle from the outside to the inside, or from the inside to the outside. But it's done very exactingly.
Very precise, and this thing weighs a ton. And we have a wooden base holding it up now, but the original base would have been concrete. So there was no vibration at all. This is a lathe originally designed to cut the discs for the first talkies. You know, originally movies were silent, and eventually they put the sound on the film. But for a couple years, they tried synchronizing a record to the film. At that time, a reel of film was 11 minutes long, and it was 16 inches in diameter.
The film was?
Yeah, the reel of film was 16 inches in diameter. So they made this record the same size as the film can, 16 inches, and then they slowed it down from 78 RPM till they got 11 minutes, and the new speed was?
33 and a third RPM.
33 and a third. Yeah. And that's how that standard was established.
And that disc became known as the ET, or electrical transcription, and was heavily used in broadcast operations.
Well, the movie industry figured out within a year or two how to put sound on film. So they gave up on it. But the broadcasters realized that they could get 15 minutes per side, and you've now got, between the two sides, a half-hour radio show. And I know a few stations in this town continued to use this system up into the 1960s. Even though we had tape, the engineers could see or feel where the cut began on this record and where it ended, and were happy to use them. Whereas with the tape, they had to rely on a tape counter, which may or may not have been accurate.
Right, and you have to spin it back and forth. You can break the tape. So you've taken us through the electrical transcription, which really formed the basis of all future development of phonograph recording.
The real foundation of our programming is the Joe Pavitt Collection, which starts with our first exposure to electricity. We've got some early generators and batteries and Leyden jars.
What is this device?
This is an early generator. It's from about 1850.
Generator meaning it creates electricity?
Yeah, static electricity. You can't really draw any current. You can't run a motor with this, but you can get a shock from it.
And it's because you are...
There's two pads that they actually rubbed a little bit of gold dust on, and there's a glass disc, and as you turn the handle, the glass disc rotates, rubs against these two pads, which they actually called rubbers at the time, and... The static electricity collects along this large brass rail that kind of runs in a big rectangle around the device, and there's just enough room in the middle of that rail to put a Leyden jar. A Leyden jar is a capacitor. It only stores a temporary charge, but you can get a big charge in there, you can get a big shock, but it will not produce a continuous flow of electricity like a battery does.
It'll get your attention, but it won't kill you.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
And, you know, experiments with this sort of thing eventually led to some practical applications. The one that the Pavitt Collection is interested in is electronic communication, which we've gotten some dispute about this. I always say it begins with the telegraph. But one time I was giving the presentation and a kid said, "What about the doorbell?" And he was right.
Yeah. Yeah.
The doorbell was electronic communication, but the telegraph was two-way. You could send and receive messages with the telegraph. And, of course, the telephone, and then finally the wireless telegraph, which we call radio today. And this was really developed for ships at sea. Ships at sea could not run wires from ship to ship or ship to shore. They needed to figure out some way to send messages out over the air. And right around 1900, they came up with this device that's once again sitting all in the open, and it's not plugged in, it's turned off, very dangerous. There's going to be 13,000 volts jumping across the spark gap when we fire it up.
Oh, we are going to fire it up?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
This is a small version of the transmitter that was on the Titanic. Matter of fact, it's just as old. These components are all from around 1912. And I'm going to send out an SOS and hope somebody hears it.
I detected SOS in the keying that you just did. And you said, what, 13,000 volts?
There's 13,000 volts across the...
So how far would this reach?
The Titanic was out 1,000 miles.
And was heard on shore?
Yes, was heard along the East Coast by David Sarnoff.
We're only partway through the PAVIC experience, but we need to make room for the rest of this month's information. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service will complete our tour of the PAVIC in 30 days. Until then, an early wish for Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and good listening, DXers.
I'm Charlie Van Dyke, and you're listening to the DX Audio Service from the National Radio Club.
WCFL, Chicago.
Dream and they might. just a little bit south of North Carolina. That's where I long to be, in my little brown shack in South Carolina. Someone waits for me in each slaughter, he says. The weather's fine, the folks are feeling great. The garden looks grand and the red rose vine is clinging to the gate. Just a little bit south of North Carolina. That's where my thoughts all stray, to the one I love best in South Carolina. I'm going back someday, I can hardly wait to see the face of the one I idolize. Just a little bit south of North Carolina, I'll find paradise.
You're tuned to the Radio Thrift Shop with DJ Frederick.
Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find those extra cups to fill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. You can't get cherry soda, 'cause they've got to sell their quota, and the way things are, I guess they never will. They've got a zillion tons of coffee in Brazil. No tea or tomato juice, you'll see. No potato juice, 'cause the planters down in Santa's all say no, no, no. A politician's daughter was accused of drinking water and was fined a great big $50 bill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. Need savor, coffee ketchup gives them flavor, coffee pickles way outsell the dill. Why they put coffee in the coffee in Brazil. No tea, or tomato juice, you'll see. No potato juice, 'cause the planters down in Santa's all say no, no, no. So you'll add to the local color, serving coffee with a cruller. Dunking doesn't take a lot of skill. They got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. Man, they got a gang of coffee in Brazil. Hey, Pedro, get the flashlight, I cannot find the sugar.
Thank you.
You see the drummer stomping. Drum boogie, drum boogie.
Drum boogie.
It really is a killer. Drum boogie, drum boogie. The drum.
What a very cool set of 78s there here on the Radio Thrift Shop. We started out with the Pied Pipers and Dream from 1945, then Claude Thornhill and Snowfall from 1941, Gene Krupa and Anita O'Day, just a little south of North Carolina. Then we heard Frank Sinatra with the Coffee Song, Al Hurt with Perky, which you may recognize as the music from the Maxwell House coffee commercials. And we wound that set up with another Gene Krupa tune with Irene Day on vocals, Drum Boogie. Well, thank you for listening, and thank you for taking this musical journey. I'll be back next week with another edition of the Radio Thrift Shop. And until then, take good care of yourself, take good care of your community, and take good care of those you love.